Thanks for downloading Politics Weekly, which is brought to you with the support of Squarespace. To find out more, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
Prime Minister on his way out, a Brexit without a contingency plan, the markets in turmoil, an opposition in meltdown. It's anarchy at Westminster, so what happens next? Meanwhile, there are reports of a surge in post-Brexit racist incidents across the country. The Conservatives begin their process of looking for the next Prime Minister. We'll have a look at the candidates. But meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn faces a leadership challenge and the problems for Labour are beginning to look existential. Joining me to try and distill some order from this chaos, we've got The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland, from The Observer Nick Cohen, and also Ewan McCaskill. It's been a week of sheer chaos in British politics. Having voted to leave the European Union, it quickly transpired that neither the government nor the Leave campaign had any idea about what to do next. Jonathan, for a country that once prided itself on orderly kind of government, we might think the Leave campaign are a bunch of chancers, but shouldn't Whitehall have had a plan? Has the kind of Rolls-Royce civil service broken down?
I don't think you can put this onto Whitehall, because any plan they would have had would have collided with the reality of a Prime Minister resigning, a Labour Party opposition devouring itself, and immediately a battle for the succession within the Conservative Party, in which nobody has been ready to sort of step up and say they're ready to run the country. So, you know, Whitehall contingency planning is one thing. They should have had it, you know, we can say that. And I suspect they probably do for the Brexit negotiations. But for this moment, for essentially a political crisis, not a constitutional crisis, but it is a political crisis, you can't turn to the civil servants for that. That's where you have to turn to the nation's leaders to lead. And they're not. Part of the reason why there's excitement about Theresa May's launch is she did seem capable and in charge, and the sort of smack of firm government. And that alone is reassuring at a time of chaos.
Nick, let's just take a step back. You've written in fairly trenchant terms about the lies of the Leave campaign. And so maybe that puts them on a collision course with reality. What are the biggest fibs as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think it ties into what you and Jonathan were saying. How can Whitehall plan to implement the campaign promises of a Leave campaign that promised to simultaneously cut immigration, retain full access to the single market without being a member of the EU and without accepting free movement? How can Whitehall possibly plan for promises to spend tens and tens of billions of pounds to spend on everything from agricultural subsidies to more money for the NHS? All any civil servant could say is, this is impossible. Mm. You are offering the big rock candy mountain, the magic money tree. You know, you have sold 70 million voters a fairy tale. We can't plan for that. It's like planning for us to send Cinderella to the ball. It's just not going to happen. And that's, incidentally, that is why I think, and I'm fear it's going to get much worse, there is so much apprehension and confusion in the nation.
Ewan, I mean, it sounds like there was a clear majority, if a narrow one, in the country against a proposition, which is that we stay in the European Union. But maybe there was no majority for any proposition, you know, about whether we have a kind of half in the EU or we're totally out. And it's going to come to Parliament now, isn't it? Someone is going to have to marshal a majority for some kind of proposition, and we don't know what it is yet.
I mean, the problem with referendums is, you know, too often they're not about, you know, what's on the table, even though what was on the table was fairly vague. The referendums turn into a vote on the popularity of the Prime Minister of the day or something else. In this case, it's just about this huge antipathy towards politics, this huge antipathy towards Westminster. So whether people like the result or not, people voted for it and you have to respect that. There's no the idea that somehow you can say this is going to happen and let's find an alternate exit route is unfair to the democracy, and it's just going to make people even more disillusioned. Parliament has to pass this. How they're going to do it, I don't know. Talk about a second referendum, I think it's a bit pie in the sky. But there's so much cynicism in the UK about politics these days, and I think you have to respect this vote.
Well, yeah, but, sorry, respect what? How are you going to deliver a stop or massive diminution in EU immigration without severely harming the economy? Yeah, I actually think the cynicism is going to get far worse. And the real cynicism to look for is the cynicism of the people who voted Leave, who were told, who were given these promises. Now, it is quite clear that these are right-wing people. Conservatives will be desperate. The pressure on them from business and the city will be enormous to cut a deal with the EU that still allows us full access to the single market, and that will mean no controls on EU immigration. Then all those people will have every right to say, we were lied to and we've been stabbed in the back.
I agree with you totally on all these things. And everything you've written and everyone else has written about how disgraceful the Leave campaign was and all the lies I've told. But having said that, if you now ignore this result, you're just going to add to the cynicism that's out there, the sense of alienation, the disillusionment. There's no easy answer to this. We're not responsible for this mess. So it's difficult to say, well, you find a way out of it.
There's reports of increased racist attacks and racist abuse on the streets, something quite horrible in the mood, Jonathan, if there isn't a political answer.
No, the spike in hate crimes, 57% was reported in the immediate aftermath of the vote. Oddly, even on, I was in Westminster within hours of the vote, and a very odd thing happened. I was interviewing Daniel Hannan, and a guy came over and obviously felt emboldened to speak in the most racist terms. He was saying, now they've done all the plumbing, let's send the polls back home. Why don't we tell them the job's done? He said to me, you work for that rag, don't you, that loves Muslims. And this was a guy who just had the confidence to do it. That's what struck me about it, as if we've had the green light for this now. And that's just one tiny example. And you know that all kinds of examples are happening in the country, children being abused in playgrounds for being Polish or Muslim or different. So that is a real ugliness, because this seemed to unleash that or ratify it some way, to legitimate it. The point about trust is so important, because it is that distrust and cynicism in the system that led so many people to vote Leave. It wasn't really a judgment about sovereignty or the bureaucracy of Brussels. And yet now they will be disappointed. And the only argument between the Conservative Party, rival Conservative Party candidates, is in whether they stick to the letter of Leave, but in every other respect make it actually stay, or whether they fully go for Brexit. And you just, now we're into reading between the lines, but I don't think any of them will give and deliver what the millions of people who voted Leave thought they were going to get, and therefore there will be disappointment and cries of betrayal, and ready to exploit that is Nigel Farage, who will say, I was the only one who really meant it and would have delivered. So the prospects for the politics of this country and for xenophobia are very, very bleak.
Well, one place that reality set in very quickly was in the City of London, where huge bets had been made on Britain remaining in the EU, bets that had rapidly to be reversed. Jill Traynor is the Guardian City editor, and I asked her for her take on the week.
Well, Friday, as the results were coming in, the first thing you could see was the way sterling was moving. It fell very sharply as the results started to come in, and it looked as if it was going to be a Leave vote. You have to remember that as the polls closed at 10 o'clock, if you can cast your mind back that far, on Thursday the 23rd, the expectation had been that it would be a Remain vote. Sterling hit $1.50, very high level. And by the time London was getting going on Friday morning, it had fallen to a 30-year low, down to 1.32. And sterling, in fact, has been the biggest barometer for the markets as an indicator of what people are thinking. And the pound hasn't gone back up to that 1.5011 at all, but it has stabilised a bit, but still at levels that are, around the 30-year low level. Stock markets have been a bit different. They fell very sharply in the wake of the result, but actually they are actually, at least as we sit here talking, they've just closed higher than they were before the referendum result was known. So make of that what you will. Some shares are down very, very, very sharply. Bank shares are down. Insurance company shares are lower. But some of the big commodity companies, or anything that pays its or reports its profits in dollars, is doing much better. Again, it's that currency play. There are people predicting that there will be a slowdown in GDP. For instance, we can talk about Fitch Ratings, which downgraded the UK's rating again this week. They're talking about the fact that in 2017 and 2018, that their forecast for GDP has now been halved. So they're talking about 1% growth in each of those years, just below 1% growth in each of those years. And they'd have expected it to be double that. That's, you know, I don't know what to say to in answer to that question. There are people who are very concerned about the impact on the UK economy.
Jill Traynor there. Well, it's become increasingly clear that whatever future deal is done between Britain and the EU, the key player will be Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel. She's been talking more diplomatically than some, I said to our Berlin bureau chief, Philip Altman. But that doesn't mean she hasn't got red lines.
As boring as that may sound, it's the line that Germany sort of had all the way through, which is that you can't, the out is out and it is in, and that you can't have access to the common market without free movement. I think that's always been the line across German politics and in the EU from the beginning. And I don't think it has changed.
You'd be aware that here there's a lot of people now running for Prime Minister or Labour Party leader or whatever, who are kind of suggesting what they're calling a Norway plus, so that you're in the single market and you might have to give some nod to free movement of labour, but it certainly wouldn't be anything like the full free movement of citizens that's there in the European Union. Are you saying that's a complete non-runner?
I think it is. It would be an unprecedented new level that we cannot assume that will happen. It would change the game so fundamentally for the whole of Europe that I think it's very, very unlikely. And I think people in Britain are treating this slightly as if they sort of had more leverage now in an ongoing negotiation over free movement. And I think they're completely not understanding that for a lot of people, the majority of politicians in Germany and across Europe, the idea of the single market and the idea of free movement of people is completely wedded together and you cannot separate them.
Well, that sounds like trouble ahead. And are they thinking of this basically as a British problem, or is there increasing concern about, like, if Britain gets special treatment, then, you know, Hungary or another awkward customer might want it too?
Yeah, I think certainly that there's a huge concern that this will trigger similar disintegration effects around the continent. I think in Germany, less so. If you look at the polls, if you look at even the stance of the Eurosceptic or anti-immigration party Alternative for Deutschland, I mean they are not welcoming this referendum. They would like Britain to stay, and I don't think even they can imagine the collapse of the EU. But they are definitely they're real concerns. And as cynical as it may sound, I think the only people believe. A lot of people, politicians here believe that the only way you can stop the contagion of this is to make Britain visibly suffer. I mean, that's not to say that they need to do anything. The markets will take care of the punishment themselves. I think there's just having this period of uncertainty until September or October may be enough. It may be enough to show the rest of to send a warning signal, even to France, that with the markets in taking a nosedive, and with Britain seemingly in such turmoil, that will scare voters off. That's certainly, how increasingly it's being received here. That may be enough, but European politicians may not have to do more than that to actually send a sort of warning signal.
Philip Altman there. Meanwhile, in Scotland, it became clear that there was at least one British politician who had thought through the implications of Brexit. The SNP's Nicola Sturgeon has been quick to make it known that she will do everything in her power to prevent Scotland from leaving the EU. Libby Brooks is our Scotland correspondent. And Libby, where are you today?
Well, this morning I am speaking to you from Elgin, which is in the council area of Moray up in the northeast coast of Scotland. And it was here that this had the closest EU referendum result in the whole of Scotland. It was basically 50-50 and Remain won by only 112 votes. So I've been up here speaking to people about why they were so keen to leave. I have to say, one of the interesting things is just on the streets, there is there's a mood of sort of stoic optimism that I think you don't get a sense of if you're only looking at the newspapers and Twitter and all of the chaos and anxiety that is projected from there. So obviously, you know, different parts of the country are feeling different things a week on from the referendum.
But if they're feeling fairly chipper up there, are they feeling chipper because they think it's going to be all right now that the UK leaves the European Union? Or are they feeling chipper because they think that, in fact, this might give them the chink of light that they need to get Scotland out of the Union?
Well, I think that's what's really fascinating about the SNP story up here, is that, again, it's pretty much 50-50. You have a lot of SNP supporters who are also, you know, inevitably diehard independent supporters who are very much delighted at the prospect of a second independence referendum. But you've also got a lot of very stalwart anti-EU supporters here too, who are now in a difficult position whereby they want to support their party in terms of independence, but they certainly don't want to vote for independence a second time round if it comes with the EU attached. So I think Nicola Sturgeon is going to have a hard time convincing those voters to vote yes in a second referendum. If that happens, of course, which is, again, completely up for grabs still.
She's sort of lost no time whatsoever in being on the front foot on all of this, has she? And regardless of where the voters are, got a very united party at Holyrood, very united party at Westminster. But what What has to happen for her to get this second referendum? And relatedly, does she actually want it?
Well, it's interesting looking at the front pages of the newspapers up here this morning. They've all got the pictures of Sturgeon meeting Schultz and Juncker yesterday. And there's, I think, even in newspapers that are not normally particularly supportive of the SNP, there is, I think, a sort of distinct feeling of relief, verging on pride, that at least Scotland has a leader who is seem to be doing something about the EU referendum result, rather than the chaos that is sort of ongoing in Westminster. But in terms of what she has to do now, unfortunately, a lot of that sort of remains in other people's hands, whether that is the EU institutions making a decision on whether they want to deal with Scotland as a separate issue, or whether it's the UK, the Westminster government, which obviously needs to give permission for Scotland to have a second independence referendum in the first place. And then, of course, whether Sturgeon herself wants that referendum. She has sort of been talking basically for the last 2 years about the need to get to a point of at least a very consistent level of at least 60% support for independence before calling another referendum. And whilst the polls over the last week have inevitably shown a bounce in support for a yes campaign, it's still nowhere near what's needed for that consistent 60%. And I think that Sturgeon is very cautious about it. And, you know, as she says publicly, this is not a position that she wanted to be in. She was most definitely considering a second referendum as a possibility in, you know, sort of 5-10 years, not over the next 18 months or so. So I think she's in a very difficult position.
Libby Brooks there in Scotland. As well as everything else, this country now, Nick, has to choose a new Prime Minister. Theresa May has announced her intentions, as has Stephen Crabbe. But in an amazing twist, the blonde bombshell has turned out to be a damp squib. Boris Johnson has shocked everyone by saying he's not running. That announcement came just after Michael Gove had told the world that Boris Johnson wasn't up to it, and that he himself should be the next Prime Minister.
No, he's been stabbed in the back by his own friends. And funnily enough, we'll have to wait and see what Gove's reasoning is and hear him out. But I think it will go back to, I think everything is going to go back to that campaign for a very, very long time. And Gove has realised that Johnson is a clown. I wouldn't say that Gove is much better. I think there should be a special circle in hell for politicians who, in George Orwell's words, play with fire without knowing fire burns. I mean, I think, but, you know, doubtless he's got his own ambitions. He's got a very, very ambitious wife, whose ambition seems to be in inverse proportion to her talent, or indeed her husband's talent. So, you know, he sees his chance and he's going for it. But that is quite interesting because, I hate to be one to break this to Guardian readers, but it seems that Liberal England's last best hope is now a Tory Home Secretary. It actually does seem to be the only grown-up left in the room.
And she's backed off this thing, Jonathan, that she'd been talking about before, which was getting rid of the European Convention on Human Rights, which would have made her a no-go for Liberals. But now this kind of Remainer might be the person to seize the Leave moment.
I think that's right. The worry is that she will, because she was in Remain rather than Leave, feel she has to bend over backwards to prove her Brexiteer credentials. I thought, even though I completely agree that they are disreputable people, Gove and Johnson, I thought that the best hope, if you're worried your main concern is Britain's relationship with the European Union, I thought the best hope was to have somebody from Leave running the country and running the negotiations on the classic Nixon to China principle, that it will be easier for them, frankly, to betray the ridiculous promises they made, because Johnson could look the country in the eye and say, look, I'm Mr. Leave and this is good enough for me. And it's going to be very hard for Theresa May to do that. And I thought in her announcement, she was, you know, Brexit means Brexit, etc. I think she's going to constantly feel, again, like Nick was saying, in the shadow of that campaign, that she has to be immovable. That said, there were a few bits of language there that suggest some wiggle room. And I believe reality is going to soon bite. And the last people to admit it will be the Tory-leaning newspapers. But the economy, when the worse it gets, the more projections there are for economic failure, the more they are eventually going to turn to the Tory Prime Minister, whoever it is, and say, you've got to negotiate some fix for this. You've got to get us out of this. We can't do it. The thing to watch is when the newspapers themselves begin to start saying, we need some way back.
Ewan, during the referendum campaign, Michael Gove went much further out on a limb, you know, as the kind of newspaper columnist that he is, in saying, no, we're not going to be part of the European Economic Area because we really are serious about total sovereignty, not paying these membership fees and being able to control immigration. So do you think he could emerge as the really stringent, the Brexiteer's Brexiter?
I've known Michael Gove for about 30 years. He was a young assistant at Scottish Television, as a young researcher. And if he came into the room just now, I would find him, as always, friendly and personable.
Polite.
And polite. Mm. What's scary about him is he's one of the most radical, fanatical Tories around. And as you say, he took the hardest line during the referendum campaign. He's taken the hard line on Northern Ireland, very close to the Ulster unions during the peace process, hard line on Islamophobia, education. So there's this contradiction between this seemingly friendly, personable individual and his very hardline views.
He's very, he is, it's absolutely right, affable chap. I've known him even longer than Ewan has. I was at university the same time as him. I'm afraid the people who are anti-establishment, anti-elite, will not take comfort from that admission. But I was, and he is a zealot, is the word I would use for him. He's a true believer. Social liberal, you know, he was arguing for immigration inside cabinet against Theresa May, broadly speaking, and, you know, was very strong on equal marriage. But he is on the issues Ewan has mentioned. Europe is now there, but certainly on you know, the foreign policy issues, very close to, you know, what were called neoconservative circles in Washington. He is a zealot, and that the prospect of that in Downing Street, and it's a real prospect given the constellation of forces in the parliamentary party and in the Tory party in the country, who are incredibly going to be making this decision, picking the prime minister for the country. He's an extreme character, and this is something we're going to have to brace ourselves for.
Nick, let's just finally on the Tories have a word about this business that Jonathan alluded to there. Those 150,000 members out in the country picking a new prime minister. Now, that's never happened before in British history, because in the old days, both parties used to have the MPs choosing their leaders. Gordon Brown managed to bulldoze everyone else off the ballot paper in 2007. Is there going to be a crisis of legitimacy?
I'm actually, I'm sorry if this sounds elitist, I mean, it's sort of one for your opinion. I actually think that MPs who select the leader of the party and the prime minister, I think those are the people you've got to work with. We were a parliamentary democracy. I mean, referendums undermine that. But in the end, as Jonathan was saying earlier, in the end, Parliament has to sort this out. I think as soon as you don't have MPs having the say, you get into all kinds of problems. Because as you say, who are these 150,000 people? How representative are they? How old are they? Well, I think we know the answers to all those questions. Mm. And by what right then does whoever it is, May or Gove or, you know, of course all those questions will come up and they will have to have an early general election, but of course they'll only call that if they think they'll win.
Which brings us seamlessly to Labour, because there's a crisis in Labour because the MPs who in the distant days of the 1970s would have been choosing the new Labour leader and the members, Ewan, and it is very hard now to see how this gets reconciled if Jeremy Corbyn holds his own.
I could weep into this mic. You know, here is a golden opportunity for the Labour Party, the Tories pulling themselves apart, and Labour are now entering into a period of fratricide that is going to be much, much worse than anything the Tories are doing. If Jeremy Corbyn has the stomach for this fight, then I think he's got a good chance of winning it.
Really? Even now?
Even now. I mean, there's a huge disillusionment with him among many of the people who supported him last time, that they think he has been particularly good at Prime Minister's Question Time. A lot of rage over the way he conducted the Remain, half-hearted way he conducted the Remain campaign, and a whole host of other disappointments. Having said that, there's equally a rage against the Parliamentary Labour Party, coming back to the point that Nick made. You know, there's this feeling that the members should be, the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, should reflect the views of the members. Mm. And there's a feeling that too many of them are Blairites and Brownites and they don't reflect the nature of the party now. So even if Corbyn wins, you could see moves towards sort of that word that scares Labour MPs, mandatory deselections. You could see this battle continuing for a long time. If he loses, you're going to have this huge resentment on a large pool of Labour Party people led by Corbyn's shock troops momentum. Labour is going to be in serious trouble for years to come.
It's hard to see a way out, Johnny, is it?
Well, it is, except some kind of split, which is not in any sense good for centre-left politics, because it means it just guarantees the Tories are in for another 5, 10, 15 years. But I agree with the analysis. I think the only question is whether or not, if Corbyn was to fight a leadership contest among the membership and lose, do those people then go elsewhere? I mean, it was very telling, the demonstration, the Save Corbyn demonstration outside Parliament earlier this week, the banners outside made no pretense. They were not Labour Party members. They were carrying banners of other parties, Socialist Worker, Socialist Party, etc. So if those people feel that this entryist effort has failed and they take their machinery elsewhere, then Labour has some kind of hope. But otherwise, it's just constant battle for a long, long time to come.
Sorry, Jonathan, I just wanted to pick you up on that. I mean, and there is this misconception. I was at that rally and I've been to lots of Corbyn meetings. You do get the Socialist Workers' Party turn up, but they're usually outside selling their paper and booklets. They're not allowed into the sort of Corbyn meetings, but they were able to turn up in the square.
And they certainly print banners, don't they?
They
Labour Party members, I suppose, could wield.
They print the placard, so it said Corbyn in, Tories out, and it said SWP. So it makes it look like it's Socialist Workers and other groups. But actually, if you go into the centre of the square, it was mainly it was Labour people, young people, the kind of young people you want into a party. They're idealistic. They're not hardliners, the veterans of the fights of the 80s and 90s. They're people who've come in, they were inspired by Corbyn's campaign. They see momentum as a social movement, a broad-based movement, you know, taking on the environment and other issues. So I think it's wrong to characterise it as a sort of hard left.
No, absolutely. Happy to stand corrected. I was talking really about the people who are, you know, organising on the outside. I take your point completely about the membership, and you don't want to lose those people. There's got to be a way to bring those people in. But I think from some of the conversations I've had that some of those people have lost their initial unalloyed belief in Corbyn because they have seen some of what's happened, particularly younger people who were very strong for Remain and saw that he did fight what our colleague Marina Hyde called not a half-assed campaign but a quarter-assed campaign. And they're angry about that and they could be persuadable. Absolutely, you don't want those people decamping. But for I'm talking about those hardcore organisers, some of those people who had left Labour in the 80s and had come back, you know, the hope is that they will go and fight their battles somewhere else. Otherwise, Labour is just going to tear itself apart and not live for another day.
But the problem, Nick, is lots of people in the middle of the Labour Party on the big arguments there's been in the last year on Trident, on Syria, will be on Jeremy Corbyn's side over Angela Eagle, whoever ends up challenging him. So they've got to run a campaign against him, which is very much just on, well, you're not doing the job, you're not leading the MPs, rather than...
Well, he's not. I mean, it's just true. I mean, I think that people get far too wound up about two things. One, the internal politics in Parliament. Two, the activists who talk to them, go to a Labour annual general meeting. Hornsey and Wood Green, the big after Momentum, the biggest constituency in Britain, 3,000 members. Only 30 people turned up to the annual general meeting. What Miliband did when he let this loose was provide the perfect grounds for parliamentary click activism. You don't do the work. You don't pound the streets. You follow your leader and take time off during the European referendum campaign. But then all you have to do is click and vote for Leader to keep Labour Party in trouble. What is being missed is the real danger that in England, not Scotland, in England, the only arguments that will matter soon will be on the right. You know, it will be Theresa May v. Nigel Farage. Labour could lose dozens. I was talking to people, Labour Party people, you know, who were happy with Ed Miliband, you know, willing to give Corbyn a go, who reckon they could lose 100 seats. Mm. You know, and all these people, they keep shouting at people like, oh, you're a Tory, you're a Blairite, you're this. They don't know what Tory government is. You know, Tories, once they get in, Tories can be in power for a generation. They were essentially in power from 1886 to 1906, a couple of liberal rules. They were in power or in coalition from 1916 to 1945. They were in power from 1951 to 1964, from 1979 to 1997. They're not frightened enough of Tories. And they think, they have this slogan, same old Tories. No. When the left disintegrates, when it goes wild, when it goes off on infantile causes, the right isn't the same old Tories. They take the opportunity and move the country drastically. And we've seen the first step of that in our vote to leave the EU. You know, people need to be really frightened and sober up. I see no sign of that happening at Stanley.
Well, on that grim note, we'd better draw things to a close. There are rolling updates on theguardian.com as the political bombshells keep on blowing up. My thanks to Nick Cohen, to Jonathan Friedland, and to Ewan McCaskill. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. Squarespace.